And then, you drive half an hour out to Mirror, and you pass by this fine establishment on, Highway 27, I believe it is. And you're like, you know what? I'm gonna speak here. Happens to the best of us. I mean, she's really awful person, and it is telling that the separatist crowd sees her as sort of this model political leader. But anyways, I digress. The point is that there is a way to cover these things. I mean, these people exist. The provincial government is trying to cater to them, not to the extent that they would like, but Smith is certainly inching things in their direction, and we're probably going to have a referendum on independence next year. People talk about I mean, that's kind of like an old thing. I don't really hear people talk about platforming as much anymore, but I've always been of the view, I think you can platform whoever you want. It's just how do you go about doing it? And in this case, these people already have a platform. They already have the ear of the provincial government. So the question is, do you let one of them just
There's a highlight from a recent episode of The North State. Find new episodes, host Scott Martin's thecatch.ca Substack, and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. Coming up next, Sierra Club Canada's The Environment in Canada is a weekly podcast exploring climate change, biodiversity, renewable energy, and democracy with hosts Jessica Murray in Toronto and Connor Curtis in Montreal. On this highlight from a recent episode, Toronto Metropolitan University Vice Provost Sean Carrage joins Jessica to reveal the history of oil pipeline development in Canada. Now, here's the show.
But I was really surprised to learn that onshore oil spills, when a pipeline leaks, did occur, could be voluminous, huge amounts of oil, and apparently occurred really frequently. The larger this system got, the further it traveled, the more likely you would have spills, and that there had been no evidence of any oil transportation system in Canada that didn't result in oil spills. So oil spills were kind of a baked-in cost of operation. There was even one case in which an exposed part of a pipeline was struck by lightning, caused an oil spill. If you're shipping 1 million barrels of oil a day, a tenth of a percent of 1 million barrels of oil a day is hundreds of millions of liters of oil spilling into the environment, right? So even a fractional failure rate can create substantial environmental risk, impacts on wildlife, effects on agricultural land, risks for adjacent communities from ignition from fire or damage to property. It was a really large oil spill in Abbotsford. It was in the early 2000s. And again, like years before that, there had been claims that, pipeline developments and technology and monitoring technology and computers were going to solve all of this. Regardless of whatever kind of technological improvement that's going to happen, there is such a vast diversity of unexpected things. Technology just hasn't been a silver bullet, and there has never been a leak-proof oil system.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Jessica Murray, Sierra Club Canada's Line 5 community organizer, and I'm part of a cross-border effort to protect our Great Lakes from a devastating oil spill. To learn more about Line 5, follow us at Sierra Club Ontario on Instagram and join the movement to safeguard the largest freshwater source on our planet. You can also connect with me every other week on Zoom, where I co-host a one-hour community building space and podcast club following the podcast We Are the Great Turning. Feel free to check out the episode with Sally Ludwig and the work that reconnects, and email ontario@sierraclub.ca for more information. Today, I'm talking with Sean Carrage, an environmental historian that is an associate professor at Toronto Metropolitan University. Sean's current research looks at the social and environmental consequences of the development and operation of oil pipelines in Canada and really highlights the time between 1947 and the 1970s. His research spotlights federally regulated pipelines in Canada. Today, we talk about Canada's history with pipelines, Line 5, and Sean's perspectives on a just transition towards a viable and sustainable future. Before we begin, just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions and events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on Harbinger Media Network, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, YouTube, or wherever else you get your podcasts. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to follow or subscribe so you can get the latest episodes from us. Hello, Sean, and welcome to the Environment in Canada podcast with Sierra Club Canada. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
I'm very excited for you to be here, especially as your projects and your work really guide and help me understand the context of my own work, being a community organizer for Line 5, huge topic as to the history of pipelines in Canada. So I'm very excited to speak with you as well. So yeah, I wanted to start off just with sharing with our listeners, who are you? How would you self-describe yourself?
Well, my name's Sean Courage. I'm an associate professor of Canadian and environmental history at Toronto Metropolitan University. And my research focuses on the history of the development of long distance oil pipelines in Canada since about the mid 20th century to about the end of the 20th century.
That's a big part of time. And yeah, that's exciting. I know that you've also, so two things that really jumped out for me just kind of looking over some of your work is that you, I think some of your research, and correct me if I'm wrong, you created a spill database for the Canadian Energy Regulator. So that really gives us a map to look at the Enbridge system and I think also the spills in there.
Yes. Yeah. We have a couple of things. So we published a map of oil spills that occurred along the Enbridge system, which used to be called the Interprovincial Pipeline System in Canada. And that map covers a time period from about the early 1960s to the 1990s. And it is based on reports that the company had to complete when there were oil spill incidents on the pipeline and submit to the national regulator for oil pipelines that cross international and interprovincial boundaries in Canada. And at the time, that was the National Energy Board, which was renamed Canada Energy Regulator a couple of years ago. There's also a database that has all oil spills on federally regulated oil pipelines in Canada from the early 1960s to the mid-1990s.
Is this all publicly available?
It is. Yeah, the data is from the National Energy Board Library or Canada Energy Regulator Library. And so we got access to it, digitized it, mapped it, and then published it on our website.
Amazing. So the other website that I quite enjoy looking through is the project called Silent Rivers. Is that also connected to what we've done here?
Yes. Yeah. It's all part of that project. So the project is a broader history of pipeline development. Part of it is looking at environmental effects of oil pipelines in Canada in the 20th century and the regulation of those pipelines. And so part of that project included reviewing and analyzing these pipeline incidents, including oil spills and explosions and accidents. And these databases that we published are focused on oil spills.
Amazing. So I'm just going to plug it in for our listeners here. If you're interested in searching that up, I'm not actually sure how I stumbled upon Silent Rivers, but it is out there. So if you're looking for the link, we'll provide it into the little summary, but it's niche-canada.org/silent-rivers/. And Silent Rivers of Oil, a history of oil pipelines in Canada since 1947. So before we dive into that, I really wanted to kind of situate us as to kind of understand the importance of environmental historian work. Because I think as a young person, and, you know, partly I'm going to blame my teacher because I did not find the love of history that now as an adult, I am far more fascinated and can have a really deeper understanding of the importance of its role. So I'm curious to know how that lands with you and kind of your understanding as your role of your role as an environmental historian. Is that right? Mm-hmm. Environmental historian?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, good. Good.
Sure. Yeah. So I think there were a few things that drew me to the field. So it's a sub-discipline of history. So you probably wouldn't encounter it in high school, but probably not until university, as you might specialize more. So what drew me was this convergence of two interests, one in the environment and the other in studies of the past, and how those two things intersect. So I was particularly interested in the ways in which nature, forces beyond human control, have an effect on choices and decisions that people can make, and what the implications of that are for history. So most historical scholarship is focused on human agency, what choices and decisions people make and how they affect the lives of people, the economies, the societies that they live in. But there are these whole host of other factors that shape the choices and decisions that we make that are beyond our control. Things like gravity, things like the atmosphere, plants, animals, geology, volcanoes, hydrology, meteorology. There are all of these aspects of the natural world that are outside of our control, but that set parameters or limits on the decisions that we make. And then even within the context of the decisions that people make over time and how they affect societies and economies, there are unintended outcomes of those decisions. And that was something that I found in what I was studying as a historian, that there were several instances in which the intended outcome or the choices that people made resulted in a bunch of unintended outcomes. And I thought you could understand that from an environmental perspective by thinking about the ways in which natural and cultural agency interacts to shape history. And so that brought me to a number of research projects that I've done on parks, on urban animals, and now on oil and oil pipeline development.
Do you have like a mini story of a kind of like concrete example that listeners can kind of understand that concept applied in real life?
Probably like an early one that drew my attention to this field and as a way of thinking about the past differently, was a book written by Alfred Crosby on the 1918 influenza epidemic and the effects that it had on American society. It was a book in U.S. history. And it was a period of American history that I was familiar with, but it was an episode I didn't know anything about. So this is the interwar period, end of the First World War, prior to the Great Depression, and yet I had never read in any of my other studies of history anything about this epidemic that killed millions of people, was a global phenomenon, changed economies and societies, was highly disruptive, and yet it was like the book describes it as the forgotten pandemic of American history. And then it started opening up my mind to thinking about the ways in which non-human phenomenon, natural phenomenon can shape events in the past, can disrupt the decisions and choices that we can make, and that we might not be getting a full appreciation of past events and a full understanding of what affects past events without taking into consideration the ways in which natural phenomenon interact with human choices, cultures, and societies.
Yeah, it almost like the kind of image that I get is that maybe outside of the realm of environmental historian work, like humans are seen as this, like in this silo of like, what are the humans doing?
Yeah.
Whereas your field kind of opens up to like, there's like a lot of other stuff going on out there that,
yes,
you know, influences what the humans can do.
Yeah. So, and it also asks, what are the effects of what humans do on the non-human world? So we can look in the 20th century at the popularization of the automobile, mm-hmm. and there's lots of scholarship on its effects on cities and how cities change through road and highway construction. There's lots of scholarship on the economic effects of automobility, but not as much on the effects on the atmosphere. There's some research, obviously, on urban pollution, but it's a piece of understanding the history of climate change. And so that's another way in which environmental history can broaden our understanding about the past, in addition to thinking about the ways in which the natural world sets constraints or affects the choices that we make, also gives us space to think about the ways in which human choices affect the natural world.
Right. And that's becoming ever more relevant in our lives, considering just the increasing severity and frequency of really unnatural extreme weather.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the challenging piece to all of this is the degree to which so much of nature is affected by human activity and behavior. So there was a period in the past, in the mid-19th century, right up into the 20th century, that people debated whether or not humanity could have such a profound effect on the environment. So if we go back all the way to like Henry David Thoreau writing about Walden Pond and pondering the ways in which human activity was changing the natural environment, up to the present, I don't think anyone would contest the idea that human activity has an effect on the environment. But in the 19th century, it was debatable and uncertain and unclear, but becoming more certain and clear every day.
There's an excerpt from a new episode of The Environment in Canada. Find it at sierraclub.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. And finally, over 900 episodes since 2016, Free City Radio, with host Stefan Christoph in Montreal, has explored the intersection of social activism and the arts in a weekly program featuring interviews with creative voices involved in struggles for transformative social change. On this highlight from a recent episode, political researcher and analyst Guillaume Hébert explains what's behind the populist right-wing exploitation of economic inequality in Quebec. Now, here's the show.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. This is edition 274. And on the broadcast this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation that I had with Guillaume Hébert. Guillaume is a researcher and author who works with an important independent research space in Quebec, which is called IRIS, the Institut de Recherche et des Informations Socio-Économiques. This is a project I think that's very important. It has tried to create an informational basis for social movement critiques around social and economic injustice. For example, issues around economic inequality, issues around the Quebec government giving tax breaks to major companies, and sort of the growing inequalities in Quebec society, which I think is more broadly reflected in Canada and also internationally. I think in a project like IRIS, the Institut de Recherche et des Informations Socio-Économiques, is important because it points to having informational tools that describe neoliberal economic reality in Quebec and in Canada and beyond that is embodied by growing inequality locally and globally. And I think it was really important to hear Guillaume's reflections about rising populist right politics and the ways that these inequalities are played on by politicians like Pierre Poilievre or François Legault in this context, who often name problems, speak about issues, but in fact, don't propose any meaningful solutions while actually digging in deeper to the same economic framework of neoliberalism with lineage back to economists like the right-wing Milton Friedman and, you know, politicians like Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, which have really created the framework of economic inequality that has just deepened and hollowed out a lot of the public institutions that so many communities have relied on for generations and also have fought for. And this is creating a lot of context of growing social discontent that populist right wing voices are exploiting. And so I thought it was interesting and meaningful to speak to Guillaume about his perspectives on this particular political moment for Free City Radio.
We're in a very strange political moment in some ways, where populist political parties and leaders are capitalizing and mobilizing on some real anger in society around things like the housing crisis, this sort of sense of economic unfairness, broadly speaking, of corporate power going unchecked. When it comes to play, let's say in the Canadian context with the Conservative Party, they're playing on this. And then also in Quebec, you have this dynamic for many years with the CAQ. So Guillaume, you are with Iris. We're sitting in the office space here in Montreal. Maybe first, if you can just introduce yourself and share a little bit about this project, where we are now, and why your organization particularly has focused on trying to give some insights and sort of strategic research for social movements in relation to these sorts of points, and why that's important right now. Thank you.
So my name is Guillaume Hébert. I'm a researcher at the Institut de Recherche et d'Information Socio-Économique, so IRIS. I've been here for 20 years already. At first, it wasn't even a paid job. We were all doing volunteer work, but with the years, we managed to find some financing, and so it became our job. So the easiest way to describe IRIS is to say that we are a left-wing think tank. So during the 90s and before, we had so many of these right-wing think tank active in the society that managed to make a lot of damage to the public policies, to bring the policies and the government, even the government itself, into the orbit of the corporate interests or the richest people of the society, their interests. So it was kind of a consensus that we needed some places, a research institute that would answer to give a response to these other think tanks. So this is the way that IRIS was created, and this is what we have been doing now for 25 years. So I like to say sometimes that my job is, or our job at IRIS, is 51% research and 49% communication, because we do a lot of communication. So it's a difference between a think tank like us and a research institute in the academic world, for example. They don't have specific objective in terms of media communication. But for us, it's fundamental. Our job is to take sometimes good ideas, interesting ideas that circulate into the academic world, put it in a format that can be understood in wider public, and then that's a big part of our job is this. So so that would. Wrap a little bit what we're doing here at IRIS.
Mm-hmm. And we were exchanging recently in what I mentioned before, the context of sort of the populist politics and how that's playing out both in Quebec and Canada, and this very awkward situation where you have sort of language and a certain discourse that names inequality, that names the housing crisis. But I mean, when we get into the details, and I think this underlines the importance of a research institute to sort of like actually decode the policy.
Yes. And I don't like to use that much the term populist at this moment, because populist per se and historically is not necessarily something bad. It's something that could be almost compatible with left-wing movements. Mm-hmm. So, and the first populists were in Russia in, I think, 19th century. And it was really what is common through all the populist movement we can observe, including in Latin America or in Europe, mm-hmm. or in the United States also. It's a moment where there is a legitimate anti-establishment or frustration, colère populaire, that make the people want to make the society more democratic, actually. So that point is quite compatible with what we say and what we want normally on the left spectrum of the mm-hmm. or the socialist tradition, let's say like this. And the problem is the extreme right and the demagogue in English movement right now we have, and that the very frightening part we have, and it has brought a change in our work, and it's a little more, let's say sometimes a little more complicated to debate with ideas in an era where it is much more difficult to have some rational debates. So when we started working in the year 2000, beginning of 2010, we still were in an era where you would be in the media in front of an economist from a big bank or a right-wing economist working in the universities, and the economists were the most influential people and respected people in the society. It was a bad thing, of course, but it was at certain point a debate on ideas. Now that sometimes it's different. So for our work also it's different because we. A part of our job is to deconstruct discourse from some of our ideological adversaries. So if we cannot, or if the debate on ideas, it's become more complicated because you have a huge part of the population or who gets so distrustful of the institution.
That was a highlight from a recent episode of Stefan Christoph's Free City Radio. Find new episodes wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You've been listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode's been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's coalition of 31 progressive publishers and get all your progressive news, videos, and podcasts in one place at unrigged.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Harbinger Tweets and on Instagram at Media Harbinger and now Blue Sky for updates on new episodes. And subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 83 socially and politically progressive podcasts. See you back here next week with our last episode of the summer. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
The rhetoric is still there in terms of crime, and it's this hilarious thing where, you know, the crime goes up, that's justification to increase police budgets. We need more resources. Crime goes down, it's also justification for police budgets to go up. Keep giving us more money, right?
You are listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
This is Bird Note. You might be surprised to learn that many birds have a sense of smell, and the odors that birds make can act as mating signals for some species. The source for many of these scents, says biologist Daniel Whitaker, are the microbes that live in birds' preen oil, which they use to keep their feathers in good condition.
And it turns out that the uropygial gland, which is the gland that secretes preen oil, is home to a really diverse community of bacteria. And a lot of those bacteria are odor producing.
So when birds rub preen oil into their feathers, they're also spreading fragrant, beneficial bacteria. For birds such as dark-eyed juncos, the pungent odors can help attract potential mates. Danielle and other scientists are studying how the genes that regulate birds' immune systems might help control these microbes.
So there's some really interesting work going on about immune system genes, like the major histocompatibility complex, which is involved in regulating parasites and bacteria that come into the body. It's thought that that gene complex will affect the bacteria you carry, which will affect your scent. So I feel like this has the potential to be this unifying set of information to help us understand how we get from animals' immune system to the bacteria they carry to the scent to how they attract other individuals.
Learn more in Danielle Whitaker's book, The Secret Perfume of Birds, Uncovering the Science of Avian Scent. Find a link on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Connor Guerin.